Hello, everyone. I hope you're having a wonderful start to the new year. Before we kick off today's episode, I wanted to reply to many of you who have been reaching out asking me how we can practice together in 2024. Now, I'm not running as many public yoga classes, but I am running a workshop and a retreat in the new year. Now, if this isn't something that is of interest to you, feel free to skip ahead to today's episode. But if you are interested, stay tuned. The first workshop I'll be running is called Inward Intention, and that's on Friday, the 19th of January here in Melbourne. This workshop is designed to help you get out of your head and into your body so that you can set your intentions for 2024. This will be a restorative 90-minute yin yoga practice, and I'll be guiding you through a series of postures to help you open up the energetic channel from your head to your heart. I'll then be guiding you through a visualization and meditation that will help you unlock your deepest desires and bring forth your intentions for the new year. You'll leave this workshop with a deep sense of relaxation and clarity, as well as a goodie bag from our friends at Good Living Only. If you're looking for a more immersive experience, then my Autumn Renewal Luxury Retreat is for you. This 3-day, 2-night retreat is for anyone who wants to slow down the pace of life and connect inwards while enjoying the incredible amenities that the luxury accommodation has to offer. This retreat is designed to be taken at your own pace, with all activities being optional, including daily yoga and meditation practices, a breathwork practice, and an incredible fire ceremony. It's the perfect escape for a couple, a group of friends, or even a special trip with mum. Spots are filling fast for both the January workshop and the autumn retreat happening in May. So if you'd like to register, head over to my website, ashbutters.com, and follow the prompts at the top of the page. I can't wait to see you there. Now let's get on with the show. Welcome to Behind the Smile with Ash Butters, a podcast designed to reveal the truth behind the masks we wear. Together, we look to demystify the human mind and its behaviours in relation to mental health, trauma, and addiction. My name's Ash, and I'll be your host as we uncover the real stories of people's pain and the steps they've taken to live a life of freedom in recovery. From sobriety to spirituality, join me each week as we uncover the reasons why people seek recovery and how their lives have changed by living one day at a time. Hello, everyone. Happy New Year and welcome back to Behind the Smile. I am so, so excited because today in the studio, we have a friend of the show returning for the third time. Diane Young is a renowned voice in the addiction, mental health and recovery space and has joined me in previous episodes on love addiction and codependency. Today, however, to kick off 2024, I've asked Di to join me in talking New Year's resolutions and how to make this your very best year yet. So with that, I would love to welcome Di back onto the show. Di, welcome to Behind the Smile. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks, Ash, and it's lovely to be back with you again.
I know, I'm so excited. If I could have you every week, I would. You know that. Now, Di, 2023 was a busy year for both of us, as we were just chatting offline before. But tell me, what have some of your key highlights been?
Look, I think the key highlights are people's awareness around mental health. I also think the key highlight for me was a couple of trips to Italy when I was doing some training with clinical supervision and, you know, looking after other therapists and things like that. It's ongoing in this world that we do professional development and take care of ourselves. So I guess that's the highlight. When you ask me, that's immediately what I go to. I also want to say, though, I do think that there's a lot more in the media now, and I think people like you are contributing to this with your podcasts about mental health, about and not just the are you okay, but the conversations we need to be having with people that we love and the people we're concerned about.
Do you think that people are getting a little bit more comfortable with having uncomfortable conversations because it's a little bit more, there's more awareness being created?
I do, and I also think the ones that aren't comfortable with it want to get comfortable, because I have a lot of clients who come and say, this is a really hard conversation to have. How can I do it? What words do I use? You know, so, yeah, I think there's a lot more awareness, and I think with just the world we're living in today, we're dealing with a lot broadly that's difficult, that's impacting us, you know, in our core, really, and they're the kind of conversations we need to have.
And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I know that on the back of COVID, we saw a real spike in people engaging with therapists, psychotherapists, psychologists to start having these conversations. But I know, you know, having visibility to your books, people are impossible to get into these days. Is that because there has just been, people have continued to ride that wave, or are there other challenges that have arisen on the back of COVID and the society that we now live in today?
Look, I think it's both, Ash. I think people do tend to continue to come. I've been seeing people all the way through. But I also think that the societies we're living in and things we're grappling with, you know, I mean, cost of living, all of those things. I mean, look, I had a client in recently who was recently married, you know, all going well. We got through the hard part, you know, where we've had the wedding, it's all good, and they've decided to put off having kids. And they've decided to put off having kids because they're concerned about the world they'll be bringing the children into. Now, they're not saying no, but they're hitting a pause button. And I think those kind of issues are bringing people into the therapeutic space to have these conversations.
How amazing that people are even thinking to stop and pause. Yeah. I know that I'm in a similar position where I don't have a yes or a no answer to whether or not I want to have children yet. And what I've come to right now is the resolution that if I don't have an answer, the answer is no. So I can just wait and allow myself the space to change my mind if I want to. But I think the pressure has been lifted to an extent. And that led to your point. I think that there is more awareness now around having decisions and being able to make informed decisions and to be able to get the support of a professional to do so. So that's an amazing shift.
I often think it's like sitting at traffic lights, Ash. So sometimes it's a very obvious go. This is exactly where I need to be. The intention's aligned. Sometimes there's a pause, which is the amber light. And sometimes there's a stop, which is just waiting. And oftentimes I say to people, it's often not a definitive no. It's a not yet, and let's pause. And I think that can take the pressure off people feeling like they've got to have all the answers and know exactly where they're going. And
It's time. Really interesting. I feel that the older I'm getting, the more permission I'm giving myself to not have the answers. I feel like in my early 20s and late 20s, I felt like I had to have everything sorted out. And now I'm, you know, I'll be 36 by the time this episode comes to air, and I probably know less than I've ever known, and I'm probably happier about it as well.
I think that's absolutely true.
Okay, so Di, today we're here to discuss New Year's resolutions, specifically as they relate to giving up things. So we'll talk about addiction today mainly. However, we might broaden the topic slightly, because giving up things can be so much broader than just perhaps a substance or a behavior. But to start, I would love to know, what is your take on New Year's resolutions? Why do they work, or why don't they work?
Well, in my world, New Year's resolutions never work. They're usually, you know, taken, you know, a few minutes before midnight when we've probably had a little too much to drink, and it's all sounding like a great idea to be firm about what we're doing moving forward. I actually stopped making New Year's resolutions a very long time ago. I will set an intention, which I think it's a sort of less measurable space in terms of success or failure. I think New Year's resolutions often, you know, I'm going to stop drinking, lose weight, you know, change my job. I mean, that's probably the least of the ones that you'd be worried about. But when we're talking about behaviours, as you say, there's a whole lot of reasons why we've ended up in the space we are. And to make a resolution as a hard and fast rule is often quite difficult. However, if we make an intention, we're creating a new mindset. We're taking a small step towards larger goal.
I suppose as well, the benefit of having an intention versus a resolution is, I imagine for people who set a resolution and then perhaps get 30 days in or 40 days in and then they have a little wobble, it's a lot more tempting to hit the fuck it button if it's a resolution, because you're like, well, that's me done for 2024. I'll try again next year. However, if it's an intention, there's much more softness around that and almost permission to try again if you do have that wobble.
Yeah, so just taking it out of the addiction space for a moment, if we were, for example, to set an intention coming up to Christmas, a lot of people are grappling with family, you know, everyone's flying in, it's like, okay, here we go. So we might set an intention, we might have an intention to not argue with our family this Christmas, let's say, or, you know, moving forward into New Year. I know we've passed Christmas now, but I had a lot of people talking about this to me late last year. So maybe we change the lens, and rather than say I'm not arguing with them, what I'm going to try and do is I'm going to try and have a peaceful relationship with them. So we switch it. Now, we may not have a peaceful relationship with them ad infinitum, but with an intention we may have an opportunity to do that. So small changes, small advances, small steps. Do you know that? The saying, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? You know, it's like
exactly right. Okay, so let's say somebody's listening here today and they want to set an intention to maybe quit smoking or stop binging out on sugar, or they're drinking too much and they want to address their relationship with alcohol. What would be some advice around how you might approach kicking those habits or starting to reframe those relationships?
Well, I believe all intentions have to be small. The changes have to be small behaviour. I mean, look, if you've got awareness around the fact that your drinking's out of control, of course you need medical intervention, you need help, you know, to go in, get sorted, you know, get some professional, serious professional help. But if you're in that area where I think it's a problem, I'm not sure, we want to do small changes to behaviour. So we might commit to not drinking during the week and only on the weekend. Or we might commit to doing some research around some therapeutic help. We might commit to going to 1 AA. I mean, I had a client here the other day and he's been, you know, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. He calls himself an alcoholic. He's very functional, high functioning. He knows he needs to go to an AA meeting. He's even got friends who are sober in AA. And I've just slowly I've made my position clear. So I said to him, well, perhaps the first step is you ring one or both of these people and get them to take you to a meeting. How would that be? Could you do one? You know, I could see the resistance. And I said, you know, the thing about alcoholism is that, you know the story, if alcohol caused alcoholism, everyone who drank alcohol would become an alcoholic, and they don't. So if we got some problems with alcohol, then we need to actually get to talk to people who are in recovery from alcoholism. So where we came to was the agreement that before I see him again, he'll have done at least one meeting. I said to him, if you're not an alcoholic and you go to an AA meeting, trust me, you won't catch it. You know? It's like you're not going to catch it because you go. You can sit quietly, listen. Anyway, so that's our agreement. Let's see what happens.
I love that. That's awesome. What do you think it is for people? Where is the resistance when somebody deep down in their inner knowing, they know that there's a problem there? Where do you think the fear comes from in actually putting up their hand and walking into an AA meeting or reaching out for help?
Because by the time we're getting to that stage, we've actually become so reliant on it, we don't think we can live without it. And that there's and I believe there's a sort of inner, to talk to your point about the inner knowing, it's the inner knowing of understanding that if I take this out of my life, you know, if I take alcohol, drugs, food, sex, whatever it is, gambling, I'm actually going to have to sit with me. I used to always think to myself, you know, if I take that out of my life, then there'll be nothing left. I'll be a shell. Because the only time I felt that I could connect with people by that stage was when I was drinking. So I thought I'd be totally isolated and alone and in that terrible space of despair. And, of course, it's exactly the opposite, you know, that, I mean, you go to get into some recovery community, whether it's 12-step or something else, you're going to be running with people who are on the same page as you. And God knows, isn't that all what we're looking for? Connection, to be seen, to be understood, to be heard. And most of the time we've drunk away a lot of opportunities for any of that.
Yeah, it's the great disconnector, isn't it? And that's the crazy thing about being in that cycle of addiction is it keeps you apart from, it doesn't want you to get well. So it will do anything it needs to do to keep you stuck in that cycle of whatever it is that you're using to escape reality. Di, I want to stay on this topic of somebody who, let's say, I'm using air quotes here, drinks too much. Yep. There's a lot of different phrases that are around these days, some of which include grey area drinker, sober curious, there's alcohol use disorder. I'd love to know what makes someone, like, how do you know if you're a heavy drinker or an alcoholic?
Okay, so in essence, a heavy drinker, in my opinion, would be someone who drinks quite consistently. They have a high capacity for alcohol. They're not just drinking two or three drinks. They're having quite a lot. They stay on their feet. They don't have blackouts. They might get a bit messy, but they'll kind of go home, collapse in a heap, sleep, get up, have a shower, go to work. They might be a bit dusty, but they're not looking for a drink the next morning. In fact, for them, they may actually think to themselves that nothing would be further from the truth for them. It's become entrenched for them. And those are the sort of people that when they go to the doctor and the doctor says, listen, you know, your liver's not great, or, you know, your heart's playing up or something or other, and they're, you know, they probably won't see 40 again, these people, they're, you know, you need to stop drinking if you want to have a quality of life and you want to live, they will. They will stop. It's like how, and those of us who are not of that ilk look at those people with some sense of incredulousness that anyone could actually drink that much and then decide to stop. And they will stop, and they won't be necessarily irritated or angry or any of that sort of thing. So that's the heavy drinker. The grey area drinker, I think this is fascinating to me because I have a different view to some people I'll share with you. So the grey area drinker, they consume more than what we would consider a moderate amount. They have difficulty not drinking, so abstaining for any length of time. They don't meet the official criteria of an alcoholic. They probably don't have blackouts. If there was a particularly good reason for them not to drink, they could not. But it's like on a continuum, you know, this is what I think. So if it's like if you were doing a scale 0 to 10, one would be someone who rarely drinks, maybe has a glass of champagne at a wedding. At the other end is the 10, who's someone who'd need medical support if they wanted to actually stop drinking. And the grey area is somewhere between, I don't know, 5 and 7.
Got it.
In the way they manage it. They, you know, we as our Australians drink an enormous amount. It's part of the social fabric in the world in which we live. Men are more likely to drink more than women, although I must say middle-aged women now are sort of we're aware that they're drinking at increasingly risky levels. And I guess when we're talking about a grey area drinker, we're talking to those people.
Yeah, I believe so.
So they're drinking, you know, 1 in 5, maybe drinking at binge levels. And I think it's related to how much they juggle, the stress they have. They often have careers and they have children and they have relationships and, you know, they've got a lot going on in their life. But there's a part of me, having worked in this field for a while now, where I see this as a continuum. Now, if they're sort of down around 5 to 7 and they are pretty functional, and they'll get some therapy and they'll do, and they're prepared to stop, they can probably pull up.
Hmm.
Now, do they stay sober and never drink again? That's questionable. Mm-hmm. But if they don't at that point, I believe it's then onto that 10 where they're going to need medical intervention.
The progression almost starts to kick in at a point.
Yeah, and I do think, you know, I've had a couple of clients where they've convinced me that they're okay, you know, that they can, you know, they've stopped for 2 or 3 years and they can say, but I can tell you, I've watched it and gone, look, I really have some concerns about you starting to drink again. You know, they don't go to AA, they don't like AA, blah, blah, blah. You know, they think they're a bit better than that, you know. But inevitably, when they start again, the wheels fall off quite quickly. So I do think, you know, I think grey area drinking, yes, well, it's a charming way of saying that we're heading to out of control. But I'm of the view that it's like when people talk about a functional alcoholic. What does that mean? It means someone's got a job and they feed their kids and they pay their bills. Like, hello. It'll stay like that for a time, but it will, you know, get to that point where they need to be.
Yeah. So what I'm understanding is that there is a scale, but in summary, the difference is probably an alcoholic is somebody who, when asked to stop for their family, for their health, for whatever reason, still can't manage to stay stopped.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if in fact they do manage it because they're willful enough to do it, when they start again, it will, you know, they might, and the classic trap, and this gentleman that I saw the other day, the one who's agreed to go to one meeting, you know, he said, look, you know, I can't, you know, this and that. And I just, look, I had two nights out and I had 2 or 3 drinks and I was actually all right. And I said, yes. And what happened on the third night? He said, oh, it was bad. I went, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then what happened? He said, and then I couldn't stop. And it is that, as soon as those neural pathways are opened again and we really get very drunk for the first time, even with some period of abstinence, it'll you know, set off the compulsion again.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, the point about the grey area drinkers. I think it's hilarious, actually. But anyway, so if you said to a grey area drinker, okay, well, what about committing to alcohol-free for 30 days? Could you do that? Let's pay attention to what happens when you do that. You'll actually see them think, oh, my God, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Now, they'll agree to do it, but they often don't manage it. Rather than, and also what I often say is, we've got to see the upside. It's not what you're giving up. It's what you're allowing yourself to experience. So more time with kids, a bushwalk, have a swim, you know, whatever it is. All the things.
And often that takes... Yeah, often that takes a little longer than 30 days. This is the perfect segue into the next question I wanted to ask you, Di.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What do you think about 30-day challenges? A lot of people listening are probably on dry January at the moment. Then I know there's, in Australia anyway, we do Feb fast. There's dry July, sober October. What do you think of these challenges? Are they helpful?
I think they're extremely helpful for people who do them, because what it does is brings them into awareness. It's a bit like the same category of, you know, we're all kind of addicted to our phones. Try putting it down when you're eating a meal, or try, you know, having it off half the weekend or whatever it is. I think it's massively helpful because we see our awareness and we see our reliance on alcohol. There's been a lot where people will do the dry July. I had another client, he did dry July. He said, I haven't felt this fantastic since I was about like 18 or something, like he was in his 40s. And it really showed him that the sort of physical impairment that was happening to him by the amount that he was drinking. You know, he's a corporate high flyer, did a lot of socialising. But he said, interestingly enough, a lot of people, as he was, you know, having his soft drink or whatever it was that he was drinking, they didn't care that he wasn't drinking. Now, that's a real shift in community and in corporate life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. It's so refreshing to hear this. You know, I was, in November of last year, I was on a girls' trip with 8 of my girlfriends who I grew up with, and 3 of us weren't drinking. You know, I was the only alcoholic in the room, but two of the women were just choosing not to drink for a period of time. One was on 6 months and the other was at 3 months. And that just wouldn't have happened in my circle 3 years ago, 5 years ago. Like, there are just these huge shifts in all areas, like you said, corporate, friendship groups, and there's a lot more support. I know with the people that I work with, they go into their social situations and there's always going to be the people that challenge you and push you and question you, and they're generally the ones that might have a little bit of an unhealthy relationship themselves. But generally, as a society, we're becoming a lot more accepting, which is awesome to see.
Did your friends stop? I'm curious. Did they stop just because they wanted to give themselves a break, or was it health, or
so lose weight or something? Or? Two different reasons. One of them, my girlfriend was actually, she's probably the number one listener of the podcast. She is amazing. She's so incredibly supportive and I adore her, and she'll be listening right now. Now, she has been listening from the get-go and does not have an unhealthy relationship with alcohol. She can control the amount she drinks. But as she was listening to different stories of people who have removed alcohol from their lives and the benefits and the expansion that has occurred as a result of, she thought to herself, I want to give this a go. So she's the one that's around 6 months. And then another girlfriend of mine signed up to run a half marathon. So for her, it was a little bit more around exercise, fitness, motivation. But again, she couldn't believe just, you know, the flow-on effect, how it's improved her diet, her health, her relationships, her sleep, everything. So that's been really amazing to see as well.
And, of course, alcohol's a depressive. So if you've got a tendency to have a low mood when things aren't going your way, or just have a low mood generally, it'll help in that regard as well.
Absolutely. Another interesting thing about the 30-day challenges, I think, to your point, they're fantastic for creating an awareness. There's two things I want to touch on here. The first one is, this is also probably a good indication as to whether or not you're an alcoholic, because if you're not an alcoholic, you'll take a 30-day challenge and it will be relatively easy. I mean, there might be a little bit of habit breaking and a bit of uncomfortability around that, but you won't be like nails on a chalkboard. You won't be white knuckling it. Because as we're, you know, as it's explained in our fellowship, if you're a true alcoholic, when you remove alcohol, things actually can get a bit harder. Particularly in the beginning, because you've removed the solution to whatever it was that you were trying to soothe, to ease, so on and so forth. So that there's that part. So it's a good test for anybody who's maybe at the start of the year questioning their relationship, am I an alcoholic or not? Try the 30-day challenge for sure. But then what I often like to highlight for people is those bigger changes that we start to see, they come after a little bit more time, because I do think that the first 30 days you really are just detoxing. Sure, you might see some improvement in your sleep and your overall mood, but that clarity of mind and that connection to yourself, that inner knowing, that ability to go within and actually start to find the answers that you've been blocking through alcohol and or other substances, that clarity starts to come out. I mean, for me, it was about a year. I don't know. What do you think, Di?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, depending on what sort of state you are when you come in and start to actually address some of this, it could take well over a year. It could take a year. It could take a little bit longer. But I do also think it's the expansiveness. I mean, to your point before about your friend, the one who, you know, could see the expansiveness, it's a great word. I think people often think, you know, when people are using alcohol to medicate how they feel, not deal with the reality of where they find themselves in their life, life becomes very small. And what they don't realise is how entrapped they are in their way of life. And when you talk about the expansiveness, that's what I think about. You know, we stop drinking, we start to change some of the way we do life, we let go of some people, we allow others in, whatever that looks like. But suddenly there's a bigger world. I mean, you wouldn't have been doing a podcast some years ago.
Absolutely not. I always share on the show how different my life looks today, like from every area, as you know all too well, from the city I live in to the relationship I'm in to the work that I do, all of that has changed completely since getting sober, and only because I made the decision to get sober. So,
and it flows on, doesn't it, to our relationships with our family, with the intimate relationships, with our friendships. And so they become, we become, it's like we start swimming in a bigger pond.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So the expansiveness is great. Well, I hope she does well in a half marathon. That's all I can say.
Yeah, no, she will have done it by now. I can't wait to hear, and I'll keep you updated. Di, switching gears for a moment, but staying on the topic of New Year's resolutions.
Yep.
Another really common New Year's resolution for a lot of people is to lose weight. In fact, stats show that gym memberships, they peak, sales go up in the month of January. It's the busiest month of the year for gym owners. Why is it important for people to consider trauma when they're looking to address their relationship with food?
Oh, it's a big one, this one, isn't it? You know, we have two categories now. We have eating disorders, and now we have another one which is not quite at eating disorders, but we call disordered eating. And I have a feeling that those in the world of eating disorders that work with it would be say that's a continuum also. So the disordered eating, which is more that unusual and strange relationship we have with food, where we're restricting at some level because we're not happy with ourselves. And of course what happens is we say, well, it's about the way I look and I want to be a size whatever and not a size whatever and summer's coming and blah, blah, blah. That's one aspect of it that we're dealing with. The other one is, you know, body image. We're, you know, constantly bombarded with fabulous looking people on social media and anywhere else. I think the food aspect is more about can we sit with our vulnerability? Can we sit at, you know, children who are raised in families that have had some level of abuse where they're alone or unsupported? You know, they've got that sense of emptiness in here. You know, they're trying to fill it. It's like I'm eating my feelings. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where there's the restriction and the there's a lot of self-hatred in disordered eating, and it's very, very painful. I mean, the thing about every other addiction is, you know, you can stop taking alcohol, drugs, you can even, you know, gambling.
Yeah.
You can even curb how often you have sex. I mean, you know, it's not going to, but you have to eat to live. So there's a very significant time where we need to see it. And this is where, to talk about resolutions and intentions, I mean, the intention in terms of food and your body image, you know, perhaps it's easier in some ways or more compassionate with yourself to just set one word. Now, that could be health, it could be vitality, it could be confidence in myself, you know, so that whilst I appreciate if we've got an eating disorder, we need medical intervention and we need to take a lot of care, and the family support for that could be very helpful. But when we're in the disordered eating, not quite there yet, and we can actually take some steps, I think we'll often do time restrictions with eating. I'm going to lose X amount of weight by such and such. So to your point that you raised at the beginning of our podcast, there, as soon as I break that, it's like, oh, I'm failure. I can't do it. So let's not push too much about the resolution, but more the intention. So the intention might be less concrete in its outcome. It might be more about, I'm going to do a bit more physical exercise. I'm going to take up dragon boat racing or bushwalking, or, you know, I'm going to do some more enjoyable things with friends outside, you know, so that there's tiny steps that start to change. And you know as well as I do, we start to do small, small things and we get a little bit of positive reinforcement from friends, positive reinforcement from ourselves. We'll take the next step. I do think that, you know, we've become very hard on ourselves. Yeah. I do think we don't have a lot of compassion for who we are and the world in which we live. And I think also the weight issue, or it does hook very much into our childhood trauma. Often people will talk to me about, you know, their mother was a restrictive eater.
Or yeah, that's a big mum, one.
You know, would often say, don't be eating that because you don't want to put on any weight. You know, the kid was like normal size, whatever that is, you know. So there's been a lot of negative comment around food and body image. So I have massive compassion for people that struggle with this because it's very, very difficult. And I do believe there are therapists who are highly skilled at working with it.
I don't know the statistics around this, but I would hazard a guess that it's around at least 70%. I'll just think of my own inner circle, 70% of the women I know, and probably men to some degree,
absolutely,
would be unhappy with their figure and wanting to change it in some way, most likely due to societal pressures. You know, I was just thinking about this the other day, social media and the images that just get fed to us constantly, and the fact that 30 years ago this just wasn't a thing. Sure, we had glossy magazines, but it wasn't in your face 24/7, you know. It just the pressure to look a certain way is enormous these days. It really is. And I also really relate to your point around the childhood wound. And, you know, I was sharing on a podcast recently that food was my first addiction, because mum and dad would give me, you know, $5 note to go down to the canteen while my brother was playing sport, and I would go and I would stuff my face with lollies, or I used to love the Mr. Whippy van that gave the ice cream, and I would gorge. And that was my first experience of being able to ingest a substance that made me feel good.
Yeah, it was the sugar.
Yeah.
The sugar hit, yeah, my word.
Yeah, exactly right. And I know that that is still in there somewhere, that old behavior, that old habit. It doesn't matter how much therapy I do, if I'm not conscious, then my unconscious brain, I'll have a bad feeling and then I'll start thinking about sugar. It's like that filling the void.
Yeah. And I do think there's a lot about that filling this, you know, and we often talk about that, don't we, with alcohol and drugs, but it's particularly with food. And often many addicts will say to me, my first drug was food. My first drug was sugar. You know, I'd go down the street with the money and I'd buy, you know, whatever, $5 worth of cobbers, you know what I mean, or whatever it was, and then stuff themselves. They sort of go numb. And, of course, that's the other thing, isn't it? When you're in some sort of disordered eating pattern, you're numbing your feelings. And, you know, we've got to get more and more used to, this is okay, it's okay that I feel empty, but what do I need to do to settle myself? And do I need to reach out to a friend? Do I need to do some meditation? Do I need to, I don't know, do something that isn't the same behavior it's always been, you know?
Yeah, I remember back in my, you know, first couple of years of recovery, when I would have those really uncomfortable emotions, and you used to talk to me about self-soothing, and you know, and I remember I didn't have a teddy, but I'd grab a pillow and I'd get on the couch, and we'd call it a doona day or a doona dive, and I'd just pull the blankets over my head and just hold on to that pillow and just self-soothe and let little Ash know that it was going to be okay, and to allow myself to just sit in the feeling and let it wash over me without needing something outside of myself to fill that hole. Because every time I fill it with something, then my body continues to look for something else to fill it for the next time. Whereas if you can stop that behavior and actually just sit in the discomfort, it gets less and less over time.
Yeah, it's a little ash-shaped hole, isn't it? You know, I mean, some people would say it's a spiritual-shaped hole. Maybe that's true for some, you know, but for those of us that have grappled and are in recovery from childhood trauma at whatever level it is, and it doesn't matter, then that's where we have to do our work, which is why that, you know, beautiful inner child work so helpful. Because when you check, I'm going to suggest when you connect with her and she's on board, you know, it's like she's in there, whew, no stopping you.
Oh, yeah. That's
you
so
know,
true,
you get aligned with yourself, you're aligned with the universe, you align with the people around you. There's no sense of disconnection in that.
No, so there's it's been no need at that state to use of flow. Anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My word, yeah.
Exactly yeah. right. And I know for me, when I'm in that state of flow, that's what I realized I was searching for in at the end of the bottle, at the end of a pipe. Like that's the feeling that I was looking for that I get when I'm in that state of flow.
Yeah, my word.
Interestingly, the other thing I think for people, perhaps they may not understand the relationship around overeating and the fear of being seen, which is also linked to trauma, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. And that's a very good point. And many people, not all, but many who've had some sort of inappropriate sexual abuse, well, all sexual abuse is inappropriate, but anything, even voyeurism or exhibitionism, whatever, in the family, they will try not to be seen. And the irony is that they'll actually often carry a lot of weight to not be seen because the more slender they are, the more exposed they feel, the more vulnerable they are, because they've made up at some level that the abuse that was inflicted upon them, they are responsible for, or they attracted it in some way. It's perverse, I know, but that's what happens when little children. It's like, you know the story very well. You know, it's like I have... I have someone screaming at me, or someone's inappropriately touching me, or trying to leer at me. This is my fault. We don't look at the adult and say, this person's uncontained and needs help, and they should go and get therapy around this behaviour. We say, as children, I have made this person do this, because in our immature soul and brain and psyche, that's what we believe. And so many of us are told that anyway. You know, you're making me so angry that I'm screaming at you. It's like, oh, okay, right, it's my fault. I'm bad. And so coming back to that point of what's our core belief, what's that core belief we get when we're little, you know? I'm not worthy, I'm not good enough, I don't matter, I don't count, I don't blah, blah, blah. You know, there's quite a few of them. But they all, you know, and they sit here and none of us want to feel them because they're painful. So we'll do anything, you know, the defense mechanisms kick in, whether it's humor or withdrawal or whatever it is, but we need to actually do the work on that.
Yeah, yeah. And so to your point, anyone listening along who maybe has struggled with their weight their whole life but hasn't looked at doing any therapy, maybe that's the starting point rather than another gym membership or another crash diet. You know,
totally.
Go in and look at doing some inner work. It's painful, but it's absolutely worth it.
And look, to your point, Ash, yes, it's painful. But how painful is the alternative? That is doing nothing.
Yeah.
To continue on. You know, it's that classic question we often ask each other. If you change nothing about what you do in your life right now, what's it going to look like in 3 years' time? Now, that's a terrifying thought for many of us who are unwell.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Di.
Yes.
Often people, I'm going to switch gears again.
Okay.
Often people use the start of the new year to reassess all areas of their life, and this can include work and relationships, as we sort of touched on earlier. So for someone who's making the commitment to improve their interpersonal relationships by establishing boundaries, let's say, what advice would you have for them?
Well, if you live in a world where you've been boundaryless and you haven't spoken up for yourself, even small speaking up, I'm not even talking about massive things, you will get pushback from people. So, you know, that classic quote, which I say all the time, the only people who object to you setting boundaries are those who benefited from you having none. So they're going to have a pushback. That said, I do think the step before that is I need to work out where I begin and end, because often if I've been boundaryless, I've actually given away a lot of my power to the people in my life that I love. I look to them to validate me. I look to them to tell me, you know, if it's a good time to get that job or to go on that diet or whatever the hell it is, I don't come to a decision myself and then speak up. So I've given away a lot of power. And this is terrifying for some people. So we can either be walled up, which is I don't let you in.
So that's like having too big a boundary.
Yeah, and well, that's not even a boundary. I mean, it's like if I'm walled, I'm not letting you in, but I'm not coming out either. So it's pretty hard to have a relationship with me.
Yeah.
So we're at one end of the spectrum with the wall, or the other end of the spectrum with no boundary. And what we need to have is functional boundary. And I often say to people, you know, we can. This is the confusion around boundaries can be this: you go to work, you negotiate with the boss, you know, what's your pay, and when are you working, and what's the job, and all those sort of things, and you're very functional in that. But then you go home to your partner and you've got no boundaries. So what they are is fragmented. It's that you have an ability to set them, but in your intimate relationships you struggle with it. Because you're more interested in having your, you know, we don't want to be rejected from the person we're in love with. And generally speaking, though, what happens is they don't respect us because they don't.
Yeah.
Because we just agreed, you know, we've become a people pleaser.
One of my favorite sayings I've heard is, you know, that people pleasing is actually just approval sucking. Yes, and when I heard it framed like that, I was like, oh, I don't want to be a people pleaser. No. No way.
And the other one I throw around is, what are people pleasers? And everyone goes, I don't know what. And I go, dishonest.
Yeah.
Because you're not saying, look, I don't want to go to the barbecue on Sunday with your mum because I've had a big week. What I'm happy to do is go over in the morning with a cake and have a cup of tea with her, but I don't want to, you know, whatever. We won't say it, and then we get resentful because we do things we don't want to do.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think, though, about I have this a lot with people normally when they're early on in sobriety and they're learning about all this stuff and they learn how to set a boundary, but they set a boundary with the expectation that the other person will change when, in fact, it's not about that, is it?
No. Boundaries are designed to keep me safe and prevent you from abusing me. And they're also designed to keep me from abusing you.
Mm-hmm.
They're where, you know, it's like we're not doing this in life, right? We're two people tugging along. Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully we're leaning in from time to time. We're not doing boundaryless, which is doormat, right? We're just actually asking for what we need. I actually think it goes to two things. I think it goes to how much self-esteem do I have? How much do I value my worth? Am I prepared to speak up for myself? And the second thing is, what do I need in my life so I'm, so, you know, kind of content, compassionate, loving myself versus what do I want? Because you and I both know, Ash, what you get what you want. You know, we kind of maneuver and we do that and to get what we want. But we don't get what we need because we don't know what we need. I remember a woman in Al-Anon, I tell this story, you probably heard it. She was an older lady. She's probably older than I am now, and I was much younger than I am now. And she said, I was talking about self-care. I said, no, I'm good with the self-care. She said, tell me, what do you do for self-care? I said, oh, I get my hair done, I get my nails done, I have a massage. She went, oh, die. That's not self-care. I said, what do you mean? She said, that's self-maintenance. I said, so what's self-care? She said, do you get enough sleep? Do you eat good food? Do you have good friendships? Do you not put up with abusive people in your life? And I was like, whoa, that's a different way of looking at it. So I think we need to be clear about what do I need to be able to step into power in my life, to look after myself, and to love and support the people in my life that are important to me. You know, Ash, you put your own oxygen mask on first before you actually start trying to help anybody else, you know. in our Absolutely. World, in the therapeutic world, we have a saying which we're taught very early in the piece, you do not work harder than your clients. Because if you do, you will not serve them well and you'll deplete yourself so that the next client comes and you haven't got enough to give them. And when you think about it, it's like I need not to be working harder than my family members or, you know, other people in my life. It, you know,
yeah.
My oxygen mask first. I think there's a very good analogy with that.
So what are some tips then for somebody who's listening here today who knows that they're, let's say, a bit of a doormat and they just say yes to everything and they're chronically people-pleasing and they don't know how to ask their needs to be met in their home life, whether that be with their partner or their children or whatnot. What would you suggest? How is it? What's a small step, which seems to be the theme of our conversation today, what's a small step that someone might be able to make to start establishing a boundary?
Well, the first thing I do is say to them, can you write a dot point list of what you need in your life? What do you need? Not what do you want? What do you think's possible? Just what do you need? And I would also, look, I'd get my hands on a book that talks about boundaries. There's plenty of stuff on the internet about boundaries. I mean, everybody talks about it now. When Pia first started talking about it all those years ago, nobody was talking about boundaries. I was in Europe recently. They call them borders. I think it's hilarious. I'm thinking, what are you talking about? Border. Yeah. Oh, we've got to set a border. What are you talking about? And borders. So I think it's important that they have a look at that. I do think, though, if there's a lot of confusion around it, and it can be, because you see, people will say to me, well, that's selfish, though, surely. You know, if I'm putting myself first, that's selfish. No. It's self first. And what you do when you put yourself first is you give everybody in your life permission to do the same thing.
Yeah.
It's powerful. Yeah.
I love that. I really love that. Di, we're nearing the end of our conversation here today. Good. And once again, I feel like I've just gained so much knowledge and I really hope that everyone listening along today has learnt something that will be valuable to them as well to carry out into this new year. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap it up?
Set an intention, and I've got a little thing here. I thought for the joy of the new year, it's a, you know, Gabby Bernstein does a lot of stuff. She does The Universe Has Your Back. It's a great introduction. She's in recovery also. She owns that quite, and she has a bunch of cards and stuff. So I've picked one at random for us.
Oh, I love this. Thank you.
So it says, when I'm connected to my joyful presence, I attract support from the universe. And I think that's a very nice way to go into the new year. So I'm all for the joyful presence, and I'm all for having support from the universe, because if I have that and I'm aligned, then I can do all those things we've been talking about, ask for help, all that. It's good.
Amen to that. Thank you so much, Di. I am wishing you abundance, love, joy, and every other piece of happiness possible for the year ahead. Thank you so much for your time.
And to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Di.
A big thank you for tuning in today. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by hitting the follow button and leaving a rating and review. Each rating and review helps this podcast become more discoverable so more people can hear these stories of strength and hope. Together, we will continue to remove the stigma around mental health, trauma, and addiction. Remember to reach out to those you care about, and I'll be back next week. Until then.